It's time for Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Mat-Su Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky.
Well, folks, once again, it's time for another edition of Valley Edition. It's my great pleasure to welcome on the phone Zaz Hollander. Welcome, Zaz.
Hello, everybody. Great to be here.
And here in the studio on this blustery, cold and windy day, Terry Snyder. Welcome, Terry.
How you doing, Mike? Happy ho-ho.
Good. And Mark Kelsey as well. Welcome, Mark.
Happy ho-ho indeed. Great to be here.
Well, I think we are probably needing to start with Zaz, who has had the opportunity to look at some continuing stories that have begun years ago and have still had recent events happening. And maybe we could start with the Grunewald story, because that popped back up and I think reminded people that it's not done yet. Summary, Zaz. Yeah. Go ahead.
So, yeah, this is the murder of David Grunewald, who was a 16-year-old from near Palmer, kind of the South Palmer school area. And he was murdered a little over a year ago, in mid-November last year. And there are five, at the time, teenagers accused of the crime, at least some of whom knew him. And so that case is headed for different trials. At least one trial is right now kind of tentatively scheduled for mid-May, it sounds like. Eric Allmendinger, who is, I guess, the lead defendant, for lack of a better word. He's the teenager. He was 15 or 16 at the time, who gave troopers a lengthy confession with his parents and grandmother in the room about what he said happened. And it was grim and very detailed. So his trial has been, his case has been separated from the others. There's another defendant who's also going to be separated from the others. So at this point, I believe we're looking at three separate trials. With, I think if the scheduling works the way it's going, the Allmendinger trial first. And his case has sort of been the lead case out of all of them, with just the other public defenders representing these defendants. So the one who is on Allmendinger's case is filing a lot of motions, and the others are sitting back and watching to see what happens before filing their own. So it's going to be a very convoluted, drawn-out process. And, this week there was what's usually kind of a procedural hearing, a pretrial conference, where, you know, you can sometimes get some information about where the trial is headed or new evidence has been admitted, maybe. But in general, it's usually kind of a sleepy hearing, and most reporters don't attend them unless it's a very high-profile case like this one. And so in what's kind of a week of just sad things happening at the Palmer Courthouse, there was almost a fight between David Grunewald's father, Ben, and the father of one of the teenagers accused in his murder. That teenager's name is Bradley Renfro. And it's just one of those situations where emotions are very raw, tempers are running high, and I think for both of these guys it was just something kind of snapped. They knew where they were. They knew that there was at least one reporter there and a cameraman, and they didn't seem to care. And so, nothing happened. There was a lot of yelling and cursing and just a lot of, just emotion. and there were actually the...
And that happened in the courtroom?
It happened. It started in the courtroom when Brad Renfro's father said, "Love you, Brad," as he was kind of walked out. And everybody else in the courtroom was there for the Grunewalds. And so there was this kind of shocked silence. And then Edie Grunewald, David Grunewald's mom, really quickly just said, "We love David too." And then the sparring kind of started between David's dad, Ben, and Renfro's dad. And then the hearing was over because he'd been led out of the courtroom. So Brad Renfro was gone. All the court services officers and troopers had left. And all of a sudden, it was pretty clear that these guys were kind of getting into it and went out in the hallway yelling at each other. And the person who broke up, had there been a fight, broke up the fight was Donna Anthony, a familiar name in Palmer. She was a Palmer police investigator who now owns a weapons and self-defense business. And she got between them, and she knows Ben Grunewald. She comes to court to support the Grunewalds. And she kind of put her hands on both of them, kind of like a ref does, a referee in a game, and then started pushing Renfro, who was kind of coming forward. And she later demonstrated how she pushed him, and she about pushed me over. So she knew what she was doing. So anyway, that nothing happened, but it was just, you know, one of those courtroom dramas that don't happen often and just demonstrates how hard this has been on the families on both sides of this case. You know, obviously the Renfros still have their son to see in court, and the Grunewalds don't have their son anymore. But it's difficult for everybody.
Okay.
Do you expect that that's going to change in any way? Who will be allowed in the courtroom? And
I think it will add some law enforcement at the end of these hearings, or throughout these hearings, when the Grunewald defendants are in court. I think they're going to make sure there were two court services officers who came as quick as they could. You know, they're stretched pretty thin with seven different courtrooms.
So is there when's the speculation that the other two trials might conclude?
It's unclear. I mean, the judges are so busy. There's talk of doing half-day trials. That's going to be the new schedule, I think, at Palmer Court, which will draw out any trial. And the public defender for at least one of the defendants is out of the country until August or September. So it's unclear. You know, within a few months after the Allmendinger trial in May, I don't think they're going to schedule one before that, but I know that the DA, Roman Kalachak, was talking with the judge about that possibility as well.
I know that the Palmer judges have been asking for another judge for several years. I want to say five or more years, that they sort of saw the spike in cases a long time ago, and it can't be any better for anybody all the drug
Except
problems.
Except maybe with less funding flowing to, you know, prosecutors and troopers. There may just be fewer cases to prosecute, or decisions made to prosecute fewer, say, lower level cases.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So there is just the one trial going on now, or hearings?
No, the hearings are in at least two separate cases, the Allmendinger case and then the other defendants, one of whom is about to be split off officially. So there will be three separate cases traveling.
All moving forward at the same time.
Okay.
So it's possible they could plea bargain the other couple, depending on how the first case goes.
Yeah,
that's
always
possible.
Exactly. Yeah.
And are all these teens in the Palmer jail?
They're in different places. Allmendinger's in Anchorage.
Ah, okay. Well, thank you, Zaz, for that summary. And let us turn back to you for a second summary about a long-running discussion that involves Track Palin, most recent event. You covered that, and then I noticed in the Anchorage Daily News a publication of some of the information from a previous incident in Anchorage just released. Have a go at it.
So, I know there's mixed feelings politically on this one, but a sad story for the Palin family. You know a situation has gotten out of control when Sarah Palin chooses to call 911, knowing that the police report will be public, you know, knowing the media is going to get a hold of all the details. And so this involves Track Palin, the Palin's oldest son, who's 28 now, who is a military veteran. It's still unclear exactly where and how he served. The U.S. Army has kind of stonewalled me this week with a very specific request. And in the past, we've had trouble getting details. But he does get a disabled veteran property tax exemption in the borough, and you have to have at least a 50%, I believe, a service-related disability for that. At any rate, he came to his parents' house. According to court documents, he came to his parents' house. And he and his dad, Todd Palin, had been fighting over a pickup truck and whether Track could come get it. And the nature of that conversation prompted Todd, he said, to tell his son not to come. He'd been drinking. And we know from previous cases that Track has an issue with alcohol. And that the Palin family has had some public incidents where alcohol was involved. The one in Anchorage in 2014 is one. And he came to the house, even though his dad said, "You've been drinking," and I guess he also has a a pill problem, a prescription pill problem, which became pretty clear during the court hearing. And so by the time he got there, his dad had a pistol just in case, he said, to protect his family. Police haven't confirmed this, but it certainly seems as if not only Todd and Sarah Palin were there, but Trigg and Piper Palin, their minor children, were in the house as well. They're listed as victims in court documents. And he was met by his father with a pistol, which triggered something and was probably already in a state, and came through the window next to the door at his father, who told police he decided not to shoot him, which is horrible for anybody. And Track beat him enough that his head was bleeding and there was not blood coming out of his ear, which is never a good sign. So we still don't know how seriously he was injured. We don't know what medical help Todd Palin needed to seek. But Track Palin served about 5 days at Mattoo pretrial and was released yesterday on a $5,000 cash bail to house arrest. By electronic monitoring instead of by a third-party custodian, which had been the original conditions of his release. And that's where you find somebody, a really good friend or a family member, who is reliable and passes, you know, background info and commits to being with you 24/7, you know, wherever you are, to make sure you aren't violating all the conditions of your release. And so in this case, instead of having somebody with him, Track Palin has an ankle monitoring system and a kind of a breathalyzer with facial recognition software that he has to use. I think it's going to be 6 times a day. So he's being, you know, remotely monitored by a private company and is allowed to go to work and medical appointments and court visits and legal visits and drive himself to those. So this case has obviously gotten a huge amount of attention because it's the Palins, but also it has a kind of a new undercurrent of public concern that this guy is clearly troubled, and you know, to see him in court was pretty shocking. He looks like he's really struggling with some demons. So hopefully this won't end badly.
And the background story looked at his previous encounter with the law and the path he chose to take of going to a veterans court. With a whole string of things attached that apparently he did not do, so that he went back and essentially stopped doing the recommended procedure.
That's a tricky one. I got an email from one particular reader who emails us often, just outraged over Veterans Court failing the public, the Palins, and Track Palin. And I mean, that's a tough one because he didn't finish Veterans Court, which is basically you get a reduced or no charges. You get your charges dismissed, but you have to complete a pretty rigorous schedule of treatment for, you know, whatever it is you need help with, substance abuse, behavioral health issues, both at the VA in general. That this is the program that works through the VA. And then you also have to show up for a court hearing every week. And you have to do, you know, your analysis on a regular basis. So it's stricter than the usual probation. And you also have to kind of prove your commitment to these plans. And it sounds like what Track did, and this is through his attorney, but basically decided that he couldn't work in the Valley and complete these programs. So take that at face value.
So what are the repercussions for not finishing the program?
When you start the program, you sign an agreement, a court-approved agreement, and a prosecutor-approved has to sign off on it as well. And it's basically a plea deal, which happens anyway in traditional court. And I think that's the unanswered question here, is whether Veterans Court allowed Track Palin to plea. He did. He pled to a lesser charge. He was charged with assault and a weapons misconduct charge, and then also tampering with a report or getting in the way of a report of a domestic violence crime, I think because he was accused of throwing his victim's phone while she tried to call 911, if I remember the case right.
And did that involve his ex-wife?
We haven't reported that publicly.
Okay.
So the military court doesn't, nothing happens if they don't follow through with that?
No, that's the thing. When you go into Veterans Court, you sign an agreement. It's basically a plea deal. And so if I don't complete veterans court, I'm going to have to plead guilty to whatever it is. And in this case, his agreement was I'm going to have to plead guilty to a weapons misconduct involving weapons charge and pay the suffer the consequences of that rather than having all of his charges dismissed had he completed his treatment and you know, all the court hearings that, that veterans go through. So he didn't finish the program, but yeah, he had to go back into conventional court to be sentenced.
Was
he sentenced to 30 days in jail, all of them suspended, and 2 years probation. So,
and he's still on probation at this time.
Yeah,
so there's that aspect
still on probation
And are there any SB 91, you know, implications here?
You know, I haven't seen any. I haven't looked specifically closely at that, but it's certainly true that, you know, if he were just Joe Schmo, it's possible he could have pled to, even if he hadn't gone to Veterans Court, that he could have struck a plea deal before SB 91. Certainly funding and SB 91 have put new pressure. He could have struck a plea deal to plead guilty to a weapons charge and have the assault and the other charge dismissed. You see that all the time in court on DV assault cases, especially first-time DV assault cases. You know, he did have some previous civil DV charges, or rather cases, but he didn't have any other criminal ones. So, you know, the question, the elephant in the room is whether his mom and his family's connections, I mean, both the Palins are connected in the Valley, whether their connections made any difference in that agreement, the plea deal he made. And it had to then fulfill when he didn't finish Veterans Court.
I think the image that stays with me, I obviously saw the picture of Track Palin, a very different looking person than the pictures we've seen earlier.
Yeah.
But the one that struck me most was grandparents, Sally and Chuck Heath.
Yeah, who were really nice people. They used to come into our Wasilla Bureau all the time at ADN.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and I think it's just a comment that it really does affect the whole family and, you know, not just the immediate family, but everybody and the community, too, because there's a lot of questions that need to be answered here.
Sure.
I've got one final question before we move on. I noticed in the story that the monitoring, the home arrest kind of monitoring is being done by a private company. How long has that been going on?
That's standard.
Oh, so the state didn't used to do that?
What's that?
The state didn't used to do that?
There's a new division that the state is starting through SB 91, which they're calling Alaska Pretrial Services, if I remember right, which is the same name as this guy's company. And he was part of the group that created the Pretrial Services Division. But before that, I don't know. I think it was a contracted service for some time, Mark.
And was that the same deal for the guy who skipped his house arrest and went back out after his victim?
No, he was on third-party custodian. He wasn't on electric monitoring. He was at his parents' house, and they were supposed to be watching him. Those are two different things.
So electronic monitoring is supposed to be a little more secure than third-party custodian?
It is because you don't have a person who can make mistakes watching you.
Yeah.
There have been a lot of problems with the third-party custodian system.
Okay.
Because, you know, we're only human.
Mm-hmm. Well, I will go to the well one more time. Zaz, you're working on another story involving a woman here in the Valley. Maybe speak to that.
Oh, yeah. Rachel Mallard, who is a woman who moved to Alaska in early fall, I think September maybe, and then by just after Halloween disappeared. And she hasn't really left a trace. Well, she's left some traces. But her case has really, it happened right about when a man with some behavioral health issues went missing and then was later found at the base of a bluff at Goose Bay. And so there was this kind of, a number of people went missing in Alaska in a close amount of time. And people around here are saying, well, why didn't this Rachel Mallard case get as much attention as these other ones did? And I think part of that is because, you know, the gentleman who went missing, he has a huge family, and they're all here, and they put a lot of pressure on law enforcement, whereas Rachel's family is in South Carolina, and aren't here. They've never been to Palmer. They don't even, you know, they don't know even what it looks like and how they would start. You know, she left some possessions by the Mat River. It was her hat and scarf were found along a riverbank, and you know, the immediate appearance would be that either someone or she went in the river. That either she killed herself or someone. And there's been no evidence of foul play that the police have released anyway, and none that I've heard in talking to families. She certainly had, Rachel had a kind of an up and down mental history. But her family members say that they really don't think she killed herself. They obviously hope that she didn't. And she was kind of a mercurial, she sounded like a fascinating person who they wouldn't put it past her that she would create a new identity for herself and disappear. So it's a mystery, but one they really can't get their hands on because they're not here.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you, Zaz, for going through all three of those stories. Let's look at a distance now, because we have been talking at weeks past about the upcoming tax legislation. And as listeners, most listeners are aware, the legislation passed the Senate and the House, and it has been signed into law by the president. And we're still not quite sure of the impact here in Alaska. This will be coming out, I think, after a few more weeks with a variety of experts and accountants and so on looking at the detail. There does seem to be some obvious stuff, but it is far from understanding quite what this will mean, except for one piece that sticks out and has been the subject of an initial discussion by Lisa Murkowski, senior senator from Alaska, and that is the opening of ANWR, which will, again, not be an immediate thing. It even to say that it is open requires a variety of activities and so on, so we may not see drilling in ANWR for some time, as I understand. Mark?
How much time?
You know, I have heard the initial work may begin with exploration and review of what you're going to do and the actual regulations that are still in place for what you would do, and then go out somewhat like 10 years to say you're not going to see oil flowing from ANWR next year. I think I'm going to be safe in saying that. But there's also a question of the potential working it all out. And right now, I think those who are supportive are celebrating the idea, but the practicalities that I have seen in the past say it's going to be a while. It's not as if this is another Prudhoe immediately.
And is it also not absolute in a way that, say, election results could reverse it?
That's the great unknown about the tax legislation, even the executive orders, the variety of other legislation. What appears to be a very interesting next year leading up to the congressional elections in the fall of 2018 could produce a whole bunch of swing back one way or the other. And I think that's the sense that people who have been in this business of observing for a long time are aware of, because they look back and say, the history says you can reach out for something. And in the general comments that I have been hearing from people who are critical of the legislation are very clear. This is a very complex, fast-paced piece of legislation that is already being looked at as requiring changes once we get past the holidays. There are technical aspects, there are unknowns, and there's going to be a whole bunch of work that will be done. And this will be a Senate that will have a changed character. We know that it looks like there'll be a new Democrat from Alabama who will be in the Senate, changes the numbers.
Maybe. It's a tie. It's a tie. I mean, it's a tie right now. They found
Alabama.
Oh, Alabama. Sorry. Okay. Sorry. That was the other one. Well,
and,
it's in Alabama.
And,
not the state senate.
And we also have the question of the health of two Republican senators, both John McCain and one other, with some changes that may occur there. So right now we can say this legislation has been passed. Not quite sure what it really means, because it's also being projected to be an incentive, economic incentive, and there are others that say history does not show that this particular kind of legislation has produced those benefits. So got a lot of people still trying to analyze it, and that leaves us with probably the whole set of questions to ask the senators and our congressmen when they come back. Presumably they'll be back here during the break. Setting those questions up and having conversations is probably in order to understand quite why they all voted the way they did. Do we have anything else, Mark, as you think of this holiday season?
Just a Merry Christmas to everybody, and thanks for listening.
Okay. How about you, Terry?
Same here. Enjoy the holiday.
And Zaz.
Yep, absolutely. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year soon.
Okay. Well, I thank you all for joining us on this Valley Edition. We covered a lot of ground, some of it a reminder of the length of time it takes to deal with some topics. And nothing just finishes and is done just that quickly. Well, we'll be back once again for another edition of Valley Edition.
You've been listening to Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Matsu Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky. Valley Edition is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of hosts or guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, this station, or its underwriters. If you have any comments or questions about this program, email manager@radiofreepalmer.org.